people have powerful feelings about the traffic in Los Angeles, it says something that local officials warned motorists about a temporary road work closure on the 405 last year by calling it Carmageddon. Angelenos took the hint, and this weekend they're expected to steer clear of the latest 405 closure, named, of course, Carmageddon 2. That's how it is in L.A., a snarl of overstuffed freeways and commuters who keep their cool, except when they don't. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has this profile of a punk rocker whose music expresses the insanity of L.A. traffic while extolling the virtues of public transit.
Couple of things you need to know about Eddie Solis. He lives in L.A., loves the band Kiss, and does not own a car.
Being someone who's from L.A., born and raised, and, you know, having a few cars in my past, I saw the city much differently through a different perspective through the eyes of a bus rider.
Want to just go all the way to the back?
Sure. Line 18, Wilshire Western Station.
Just steps from the front door of his home, across the street from a tortilla factory in L.A.'s Boyle Heights neighborhood, Solis catches a bus that connects him with the city's subway and the commuter train he catches to his day job at an indie record label in Hollywood.
It just opened me up to, like, little neighborhoods, galleries, clubs, bars, just everything. Just seeing what's out there, little pockets of the city.
Solis's journeys aboard L.A. buses and subway cars informs a lot of the material on The New Los Angeles Part 1, Through the Eyes of a Bus Rider, the latest release by the singer-guitarist band It's Casual. In Solis's vision of a new Los Angeles, people abandon their cars, climb aboard public transit, and rediscover their communities. One song extols the virtues of the L.A. County Metropolitan Transit Agency's Easy Pass and the urban underbelly it introduces to the rider.
And that's a nod and homage to, you know, the people who know what you can even go cheaper and really beat the system and really steer away from spending money on gas and oil profits and all that. Is all it takes for me to witness racial tension, for me to witness illegal aliens. It's not to paint a negative picture, it's just my perspective of what is seen.
Off the bus and back on the street, we make our way past a jazz saxophonist playing for pocket change and down a long escalator to catch a train.
So, where are we now?
We're at the Red Line station, the Pershing Square station in downtown L.A.
And what's our destination?
We're going to go downstairs another tier, and about 5 minutes, we're going to get on the Red Line going northbound.
Okay, yeah. Let's go.
The Metro Red Line snakes from North Hollywood to downtown Los Angeles. It's the train that inspired It's Casual's signature tune and spawned a viral internet video. It was partly filmed late at night on a moving train as it hurtles from station to station. Solis thrashes away on his guitar and barks the lyrics, which celebrate the Red Line and call out the congested freeways that coil around Los Angeles.
Este es un tren de Metro Red Line a North Hollywood.
The thread that comes out of the record that ties everyone together is just like, be alive, don't be a victim of having a car.
MTA spokesman said he couldn't comment on Eddie Solis's furious pro-Metro message, but the Red Line video was a hit at the offices of Move LA.
Eddie's done a good job. Thank you, Eddie.
It's the public transportation advocacy group headed by former Santa Monica Mayor Denny Zane. He liked the juxtaposition of Solis blissfully riding L.A. public transit in one scene with scenes of the band raging against those notorious freeway jams.
Eddie is all frantic when he talks about highways. And so mellow when he's like grooving on a skateboard and on the bus and on the Red Line, there's a metaphor for the transformation, you know, from the, oh my God, I just got to get out of the traffic to, hey, this is cool. I can mellow out.
Or you can blast the tune like Too Many People as you claw your way across Los Angeles by car, bus, or skateboard. Too Many People could also be a motto for It's Casual. Over the years, the band whittled itself down to a power duo of Solis and a rotating cast of drummers. So you may think the burly, bearded punk rocker just can't get along with freeways, with people, or his native L.A. Not true.
I love it. I love everything about it. I've traveled throughout the U.S. many times, and I could never look forward enough to coming back. The weather, the different cultures, the landscape. I was just like, you know what? Now I know why everyone moves to L.A.
Solis will bring the love and the volume during a Red Line mini tour next month. It's Casual will play a different venue within walking distance of several Red Line metro stops from Union Station to West Hollywood. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is our technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Thanks to Hank Hadley at KCBX. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Catherine Borgeson and Rachel Johnson. Tyke Hendricks is our elections editor with production help from Tina Lauerberg. We had editing support from Paul Rogers. Victoria Malione is our associate senior producer. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment. Health happens in schools at calendow.org. And Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information at chevron.com.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. I-5, the I-10. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The 605, the 101, the 101, the 101, the I-10, the 210, the 605, the 101, the 405, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The red light.
I'm Edward Solis, producer, host of Los Angeles Nista, and tonight is the first installation of the Record Store Day series. Record Store Day is a very important day to independent music retail, and it has been for the last few years. throughout the last decade and a half, there's been a significant decline in CD sales, and we've seen the rise of iTunes and other digital service providers and the demise of the good old-fashioned mom and pop due to the Walmarts and Best Buys. And the Record Store Day idea is actually to commemorate existing physical Record Store Days, and all the labels, you know, basically get organized and release great releases just for that day to get you out of your house and right to that record store, where, you know, wherever that may be, Orange County or Cincinnati or Chicago, and want to get you in the store and buying records just the way we used to do it back in the day. So I feel it's my duty to really, you know, collect information from all the different record stores out there that I have a relationship with, and, you know, be able to spoon feed people that don't know what it is. And hopefully it resonates and you all get something out of it and get inspired to go buy some music the old-fashioned way. So as far as tonight's guests, we're going to have a gentleman named Rick Tyner calling in from M Theory in San Diego. And he's going to give us the lowdown on what's going on with his store. And we're also going to be talking to a gentleman by the name of Mike Gitter. He's coming in the studio, and he's actually done A&R throughout the years at labels like, you know, Atlantic Records and also Roadrunner. And I've worked with bands like Megadeth, Dragon Force, and Civ, the Melvins. And so as far as the actual Record Store Day series goes, we're going to be doing these not on any set schedule, but we're actually going to, you know, seize a moment when people are available, put them together, and right before Record Store Day, we're actually going to do a big promotion and get all the podcast up at one time and have everything in one place so people could pick and choose who they want to listen to. But as far as our first guest, he is calling in, and his name is Rick Tyner. Rick, are you in?
I'm here. What's up, man?
Hey, Rick. How are you, man?
Doing great, Eddie. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. Thanks for calling. So I wanted to let the people know out there who we're speaking with. This is Rick Tyner, who is the owner of an independent record store in San Diego called M Theory, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. Now tell us, how long have you owned this record store?
I've only been at it for just about 4 years now. But M Theory's been around for about 12 years now.
Right, right. Now, what I wanted to reveal to people that don't know how much work goes into running an independent record store, you know, I wanted to paint a very clear picture and let them know the details, you know, behind the madness as far as all the different all the different buyers that you have to have lined up to do the buying, like maybe genre specific, you know, new and used, trying to figure out, you know, where's the best place to get your product from, because I'm sure there's many options, and you want to like make sure there's a margin for you when you sell it and you're not getting, you know, overpaying for the stuff, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're a small operation, so I got two employees and myself, and, you know, I pretty much handle all of it as far as the buying. The used stuff, though, my guys help out with a lot. It's a lot of work, but, it, you know, labor of love.
Right. Right now, how many vendors would you say you have?
Ooh, I've never actually counted, but I would guess upwards of 20.
About 20 vendors that you buy from.
Yeah.
Right. And those vendors, I mean, you probably use some of the same ones to get the same stuff, maybe just at different times of the week or something like that, like different one-stops and distributors. And, I mean, I'm thinking, well, you have a vendor for imports, right?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I have a one-stop that's like kind of like a 7-Eleven convenience store, which is nice, and it's easy, and I use that twice a week. And but you get better prices when you go direct, so I do a lot of direct ordering. And it's fun to go direct, too, because you build relationships with people at labels, and it's, you know, just makes it feel a little more connected.
Right. Now, as of right now, how many labels, actual record labels, do you go direct with?
Oh, you're making me count numbers. I don't know exactly. Like I said, probably upwards around, like, I don't know, 15 to 17 or so, 18.
Right, right. So it's mostly labels you go direct with, not just like a lot of distributors. You deal with a lot of labels direct.
Yeah. And then, I mean, obviously there's some of the main distributors as well out there that we do work with as well. But right. Yeah, I prefer to try to go direct if I can. I mean, it saves us money. It saves the customer money. And it's just kind of a good way of staying as independent as possible.
Exactly. Now, I think an important part of this conversation is going to be about the vinyl format. In the last 4 years since you've started as the owner of Imp Theory in San Diego, how much of an increase have you seen in vinyl?
Percentage-wise, we're definitely putting more effort into our vinyl sales than we are on CD. But CD sales are still strong. I mean, I don't know. People are saying it's maybe a dying media, but I wouldn't say it's a dying media, at least from our end. It's definitely still pretty strong. But we're more on like maybe 65% vinyl and the rest on CDs. And actually, I mean, cassettes are even making a little join to the...
Right. Now, yeah. And that's what is very exciting about these episodes we're going to be doing because, excuse me, I strongly believe that every store has their own story to tell. Okay, being in a different region, as far as like you know, Imp Theory being located and established in San Diego, California, I feel that you know every store throughout the country that I'm going to interview is going to have a different story to tell. And what you're saying is, you know, CD sales, both new and used, are still pretty solid as far as like a steady momentum goes.
Absolutely,
that's great.
Yeah.
And as far as the vinyl sales go, is it harder to stock more vinyl because of the space issue, because they're bigger than CDs?
Yeah, I mean, we're a smaller store. I mean, our square footage isn't an amoeba, which would be nice to have all that. But at the same time, I think it must be a lot of work for those guys to keep those things stocked, but with quality. Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, space is an issue because it's more space and more the expense of rent is going to be. So, we definitely, we make the room for the vinyl because it's what we do.
No, right. Now, as far as catering to the vinyl, you know, lover, have you guys started to carry turntables?
Yes, absolutely.
So hardware, yeah. So carrying hardware for the vinyl freaks, that's like part of the deal, I would say, right? I mean, you want to make sure you're going to offer them the record and something to play it on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because there isn't a lot out there as far as, like, quality turntables. And just recently, actually, a lot of the independent record stores, I'm going to kind of do a quick plug on this one company that I'm still not, the verdict's still out, but they did a Kickstarter campaign. The name of the company is Orbit Turntables, and they're offering a high-quality turntable at a very affordable price. And I know a lot of the other independent record stores kind of helped them out with the Kickstarter campaign, I definitely was one of them, and I'm very excited. They're in manufacturing now, and they're saying maybe May to June that they'll be ready to go, so we can actually test them out and see if they are what they're claiming to be. And yeah, I'm really hoping that they are, because it could be a big step, because turntables get really expensive, especially for something quality, and it's hard to sell garbage turntables, which a lot on the market right now are, and it's a bummer that they are, and it's hurting, I think, in a lot of ways, it's hurting vinyl sales, as well as just, you know, it's not giving the listener the quality they deserve.
Right. Now, as you know, as a business owner, what is the standard margin vinyl versus CD?
As in, like, how many sales do I do vinyl versus CD?
Well, I mean, when you say
margin-wise.
Yeah, margin-wise, like when you bring a new product from a distributor or label, is this markup standard across the board?
Yeah, it's the same.
Okay.
For both, for CD and vinyl, yeah.
So whatever the cost is, it's what, usually like, what, 25 to 50%?
No way.
Yeah.
I wish.
I'm just trying to paint a broad picture because... Some stores, I know, like to mark up the actual vinyl 50% of cost.
Yeah,
So if they buy something for $20 cost, they'll put it out there for $30.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, I mean, say you get a CD for $8, it's $12. Yeah, okay.
Okay, yeah, so that would be like 50% of cost.
Yeah.
So, I mean, does that sound right to you? Is that what you're doing? Because everyone, I mean, that's the thing. Most, I mean, there's a standard in place that's been installed, but many people do their own thing as far as where they want to set prices in their own store.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a big challenge with new stuff is, you know, you spend $8 to make $4. And it's, you know, if you don't, you have to sell 2 pieces just to make, wait, shoot, you have to sell a ton of pieces just to make your money back. So, there is a challenge within that. It's not a large markup to things. And, you know, some labels are good about it and keeping prices down so you can sell quantity. But, yeah, you can't mark things up too much because people can get them cheaper now on Amazon and iTunes. And so it's more about not so much the markup on things, but just creating the atmosphere and creating a good place to come and hang out and be a part of something special in a community. And that's kind of where the value ends up lying.
Right. And now let's get into Record Store Day. You know, last year it appeared that it was pretty much the biggest day for everyone who participated of the year. Meaning, Record Store Day was the biggest day of the year last year for all the stores who participated. Meaning that it eclipsed, the Saturday before Christmas, and maybe any other fourth quarter weekend. Was Record Store Day the biggest day of the year for you last year?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it's great because, I mean, it's saving so many stores. I mean, there's a lot to be said about Record Store Day, good and bad. There's definitely some larger, you know, maybe labels that are exploiting some in some ways. But it's helping us in so many fashions, helping so many stores across the world now, you know, stay in business. It gets us through our slow months. It's our best day of the year, for sure.
What's the average amount of titles that come out exclusively for Record Store Day?
That's a great question. It's grown every year.
I hear different things. I mean, sorry to interrupt you. Would you say 300-500 different titles? Does that sound realistic?
I don't even know. I have the list, and I've done all my orders and everything, but it's honestly that massive this year that I don't know a number on how many. Yeah, a couple hundred for sure.
For sure. I mean, I've heard different things, you know, from different people. I mean, would it sound out of whack if it was actually 400? Would you doubt that, or would you say it's pretty possible?
More than a couple hundred?
Yeah, like 400 titles.
Yeah, I would max out around 400, I would assume. I mean, you can go on to recordstoreday.com, and they have the list there, and I mean, you could count them. They don't have them numbered, so I'm looking at it right now. But there's definitely a couple hundred.
Now, as far as post Record Store Day, do you guys really see, like, I mean, obviously, a lot of people are going to come through your door on that day that you don't see all year round. You're gonna have your regulars that support music, support independent music, and actually, you know, come in on in the slow months, summer, etc. But aftermath, I mean, you guys, you know, will have a great Saturday, which is pretty much the biggest day of the year. And when things actually slow down, do you guys actually use that as like a time to like really get reorganized for fourth quarter or the next wave of a retail boom? I mean, is it actually like a blessing in disguise because you have time to like regroup? All right, we're going to take a break, and we'll give him a call back.
Yeah.
We're back. Welcome to Los Angeles Nisa, the Record Store Day installment, numero uno. And on the air is Rick Tyner. Are you there, Rick?
I am, yes.
Awesome. So
sorry,
everyone,
I lost you before.
No worries. It's the age of the cell phone, right? No big deal. Yeah, so we, no problem. We just took a break, played some tunes from Good For You, Greg Ginn and Mike Vallely's new band, and out on SST Records, and It's Casual.
And you had Mike Vallely on the other day, right?
Yeah,
a couple weeks back.
Yeah, he was on January 28th, and you actually heard that episode.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome. Love that.
Yeah, I mean, so actually, let's just take a right turn really quick. You grew up on the East Coast, right?
I did, yes.
Yeah, so you were like, you know, championing the East Coast kid Vallely joining Pal Peralta, being a member of the Bones Brigade. Yeah.
As a young one, yes, until I broke my knee and turned to music.
Yeah, exactly. So let's get back on track. So look at, so we're trying to paint a picture for people that don't know what Record Store Day is, and because a lot of people do and a lot of people don't, you know, I mean.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, it is getting larger and larger. And with things getting bigger, it can be a bit of a downside because it's fun to have it as more of an underground kind of little thing. But in the end of the day, it's just good for us little guys. I mean, it helps us gigantic. It's major. It helps us so much. It's incredible. It's hard when things can potentially get exploited, which it happens a little bit with
right.
as it gets bigger, you know, and nobody wants that kind of garbage, but it does happen. And if you just kind of stay true to the core value of what it was started for, which Eric Levine and the whole Record Store Day gang that's been doing this for a while, really, like, they go to bat for all of us little stores with big labels and big money and all that bullshit, but they're like, down to the basics, they're such solid quality people, and they care so much about the little guy and the music and the bands and the local bands and the record stores that are helping to champion a lot of these local bands and smaller artists. If we didn't have this, a lot of stores would be out of business right now, and a lot of bands wouldn't get noticed, a lot of bands wouldn't get deals and whatever else, and it's so good for everybody. Right. In this little universe we live in, that's
a good way to put it, Rick.
And Mike Watt and the Black Gang have a 7-inch coming out, so
right, yeah.
Why wouldn't you want to come out and go get that?
yeah, exactly. I mean, the fact that major labels and independent labels that do well, like Matador or Southern Lord, or the guy out of their bedroom putting records out, like everyone on. All tiers of this industry come together and they put out records that are exclusive to this day. You can only get them on that day, which is killer. Now,
yeah, and you know, and they're all super limited, and the stores get allocated, so it's, you know, and it's, they try to keep it as fair as possible, and go on with what you're saying, Eddie. I'm sorry, I'm getting excited now.
Let's talk about being fair. So, because there's, you know, you guys order this stuff and it comes in limited quantities. Do you have to limit people, your customers?
Yeah, everybody can only get one of each piece.
Okay, and that's like the standard.
Yeah, and that's for hoarding. I mean, a lot of people just like come in. Well, the deal with it is, and I'm sure everybody who knows anything about Record Store Day knows about eBay. And
sure.
A lot of eBay collectors will come in and just scoop up what they can and then flip it on eBay for quadruple what we sell it for at the store. And then there's some stores, I've even seen some stores, and I won't name names, but that have actually done some price gouging due to that fact. And it's so anti what we're trying to get across here. The idea is to celebrate the independent record store and celebrate the artists, and it's not about the money. I mean, it is great. We do make some money to get us through some of the rough times, but it's not about, like, being greedy. It's about celebrating what we do and the community base of it.
Sure.
So the people that do go and flip stuff on eBay, yeah, you know, it's to be expected. It's not as, and actually last year was like, prices they weren't really driven that high. So it's more just a matter of coming to support the store. And that's bottom line.
Right. Now, speaking of which, what are some of your favorite titles coming out for Record Store Day?
I'm pretty excited about that Stooges. I mean, it's a split with the Black Keys, but I'm stoked about the Stooges aspect of it. Mike Watt, the Black Gang, is definitely high on my radar. And, of course, the Stooges, too, because Watt's on that.
Sure.
Moon Duo has something coming, and what else? Jeez, there's so many. This is a tough year for me to... Orange Juice has a couple of reissues coming out, which is going to be pretty cool. I think Ty Segall has some that I'm pretty excited get a catch on. The Flaming Lips are doing that big box set. That'll be cool. It'll be expensive, but it'll be cool.
Who's putting that that Flaming Lips box set out?
Who's putting it out?
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to guess it's... I don't know. Am I going to get called out here if I don't know? It's probably Warner, but I don't know.
I see that, but sometimes you'll get, like, you know, indie labels maybe just putting out, like, a one-time thing, you know, like... Even though they're a Warner band, you know, an indie label will be able to do like a box set limited to 500 and like a one-time thing.
This one is actually, I'm even double-checking my references here. It is Warner Brothers putting that one out. I don't know how many they're doing. I would assume maybe 1,000 of those. So
Now, as far as like when you get your Record Store Day shipments, I mean, has that already started?
I just started getting some of my swag today, but I have not gotten any CDs or LPs. Mainly,
very
I think I've ordered
interesting.
Like two CDs.
yeah. When it comes to the fill, like I know everyone gets it through, you know, primary distributors. A couple, more or less, you get what you want, or is it always like a crapshoot?
It's a crapshoot, absolutely. And that's part of the fun of it. You know, it's like you do your best and you order as much as you can. I'm kind of ADD about it, so I get my orders in, like, as soon as lists get put out to me and get solicited, I'm there. I just order up as much as I can, or not as much as I can, but as much as I think my customers will want, and so I get on it right away. A lot of, you know, if you wait a little while, things get allocated accordingly, and the first couple of years, it was all first come, first serve. Now, I'm not exactly sure how the distributors allocate things, but... yeah, you don't know what you're going to get until it shows up.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get just one of something that you ordered 20 of.
Wow, so it's like buying a pack of baseball cards.
Yeah, so it's fun. It's exciting for us, too, as stores, just to get it in and be like, ooh, it's the one, you know? So.
Right, yeah, I mean, it's such a huge thing for so many stores. Like I said, I mean, the reality is, you know, it was pretty clear to me when I did the research that it was so, you know, so big for so many record stores in the U.S. and Canada. And it was clear that Record Store Day has eclipsed that last Saturday before Christmas Eve. You know what I mean? It's just really
the biggest
day of the year for independent music retail. And for years, independent music retail has suffered due to the giant, you know, big box retailers like Best Buy, like, you know.
Yeah.
Walmart, and having to deal with labels basically, you know, smack them in the face and say, hey, I'm going to give this new System of a Down record to them for $4 so they could sell it for $5.99. You know?
Yeah, don't get me started on that.
Yeah, and I know for a fact from working in this business for a long time that there was plenty of times where the one-stops that provided the independent mom-and-pop with supply was more expensive than the mom-and-pop going to Best Buy and buying the CDs there to sell in their store.
Yeah, to some extent that is true. But have you been to a Best Buy in a while or a Target or any of those things?
I have not been to a Best Buy in a while, but a Target, yes.
So I've been, and just for other things, but I always go and check. They have such garbage there that it's, you know, you start worrying like, oh no, maybe they're going to like surpass third. I mean, who am I to make claims, but they don't get it. You know, I mean, their buyers are just like people that don't care. They don't have the passion. It's not that they don't care. They don't have the passion that like a little store has, and not just saying my store, but like the whole, I don't know. There's so much more in depth. You know, if you're running a store that carries and you make your money on TVs and cameras and computers, that's where you're going to put your energy and that's where your passion's going to be. But when your store is only music and it's only CDs and LPs, that's your passion. So when you have somebody who's passionate about something, they're going to, it's just, I don't know, I get a little overexcited, I guess, but
Well, you know what? I'm sharing that excitement. I'm sharing that excitement with you because what the deal is, here's the deal. The music industry is made up of different components on how to sell records. You know, you hear stuff on the radio, you see a band live, You know, you read in the press. It's press, radio, and live performance. Three things, but there's one other thing that people forget about. It's the independent retail that is part of artist development, meaning when you walk into a store, that person behind the counter that you trust will be saying, hey, listen, if you like this, listen to this. You know what I mean? The tastemaker.
It's not a computer-generated algorithm of
it's,
some sort.
Human. It's the human element, the human connection. It's standing in front of someone face-to-face and connecting with them over something like music and saying, you know what? You come in here, you buy records, check this out. We've spoke about it before. The record's finally out. That is artist development. That is developing an artist. That is something that major labels forget about. I know they like to pop their head in during a record store day and take their little, you know, cash and grab on their Miles Davis reissues, which is fine. But there's no one at the majors, you know, calling stores no more or shipping them posters or you know, sending them play copies and say, hey, here's some play copies to play in your store so you don't have to open your own copies. You know what I mean? So
it's true.
So anyways, that's part of the aesthetic of walking into a independent retail store. And Rick, you know what, before you go, do you want to say anything? Pearls of wisdom?
Well, I won't do any pearls of wisdom because I've already extended all of that. But I will say that if anybody is in the San Diego area, because I know you're broadcasting out of L.A.
Well, no, this people could stream online, and we have listeners around the world, actually, right now.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, worldwide people, if you happen to be in San Diego on April 20th, it is Record Store Day. And aside from just all these great titles that they're going to be putting out, we have some great local bands playing, the Teenage Burritos, as well as the Plateaus.
Awesome.
Which Teenage Burritos are up on Burger Records, an L.A. label, and Plateaus are on
Orange County. I think Burger is Fullerton, right? I think Orange Burger is a Fullerton
label.
Oh,
are they?
I think
so. For some reason, I thought L.A., but okay. North of us, I know that. We got Sector 9 Skateboards, Sioux Magazine, St. Archer's Brewery, and Lefty Chicago Pizzeria all helping us out to do this. So it's going to be it's a fun day, and you know, aside from all the business aspects of it, it's enjoyable and fun for everyone.
Very cool. Well, we're going to let you go. We're going to let you get back to your calm Thursday evening in San Diego before the madness happens tomorrow at your store. Opening up the store and diving into it head first like you do every day. I commend you for that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right, and thank you very much. We're going to get into some more music. And Rick Tyner, thank you very much. Everyone, his store is M Theory in San Diego. Make sure you check it out. All right, welcome back to Los Angeles Nista. This is Edward Solis, your producer and host for the evening. Well, I guess always. And welcome to the first installment to the Record Store Day installation and series. And we just had an interesting conversation with Rick Tyner, the owner of M3 Records in San Diego. He had a lot to share. And our in-studio guest for this first installment is none other, the one and only Mike, G to the I, to the T, to the T,
to the E, to the R,
to the R from the NYC.
Yeah.
Or is it Boston?
It's Boston, actually.
You claim Boston.
You know what? 2 decades plus in the
Boston hardcore
area. Oh, dude, come on.
I just love saying that.
SSD, dude.
I'm a huge, huge SSD. Mike Gitter fan.
NFX.
Now, I want to let everyone know about your first zine that you did. Well, the zine, not the first zine, your zine that you used to put out.
You're talking about Triple X fanzine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're talking about Triple X fanzine.
I am talking about Triple X fanzine.
As I was taking off the big can headphones, which are just the most obtrusive things in the world.
It's intrusive because this is a very professional, big studio.
Okay, well, that's cool.
Right?
I tend to think of myself as professional, but yeah, from 1983 to 1987 or 88.
Right.
I did a fanzine called Triple X.
Sure.
And it was kind of a second generation Boston hardcore zine.
But would you say it was definitely a straight edge, literature? Or
I wouldn't call it straight edge literature. I would say,
was there a compromise?
It was influenced by the whole Boston hardcore scene.
Okay.
Which, definitely had a very, very sort of sectarian approach to things. Mandated by Mr. Alvaril from SSD Control.
Yep.
And everything sort of followed from there. But I would say, no, it was really about, hardcore at the time. I think one of the things that was great about that zine is we sort of, were able to focus on, I was just interested, one of the things that just intrigued me about that scene at that time was how different all the bands were.
Okay.
And how unique all the bands were.
It wasn't like, it wasn't a sterile hardcore scene where everyone looked and sounded the same. Because to me, that's what's happening today. There's a lot of bands that look and sound the same.
Yeah.
It's like a barrage of, overload.
Well, and I think, unfortunately you have a scene that's just become homogenized. Which happens,
Yeah. It happens everywhere with every scene. I mean, Sunset Strip, glam metal, hardcore, it's going to happen, right?
Right. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with information being so at our fingertips.
And available.
Exactly.
Free.
Free. And when you have a sense of isolation, you have scenes. And what springs up are different sounds, different ideas, different personalities. And, so consequently you have completely different, sound coming out of Boston and completely different sound coming out of D.C. as well as the Midwest,
sure.
As well as Austin, Texas.
And Los Angeles.
And Los Angeles, of course.
It seems like, the analogy I've always used to people that don't know hardcore or never had any roots of hardcore punk rock. I'd say, it's very much like gangster rap. It's very regional.
I would say so.
You got West Coast, you got East Coast, you got South, you got Midwest, you got Upper State New York, right?
But you know what? On the East Coast or the West Coast, you have different sounds and different scenes. There was, like I said, there was a difference between what was going on in New York City and what was going on in Boston. Culturally, the two places were incredibly different. Massachusetts is a lot more, it's a quieter town.
Sure.
It's going to have one, it's a little bit more homogenous. It's a smaller city, than say New York.
Right.
And, the kids growing up in New York had a completely different mentality than kids growing up in D.C. or Boston, or even Raleigh, you know, even Raleigh, North Carolina.
Maybe they were just running freely a little more, you know, on a bigger canvas.
Well, they're having more, you know, they're having more fun in New York City.
Sure, New York's all right.
Especially if you like saxophones,
or if you want to freeze to death,
or if you like art and jazz,
or if you're homosexual.
You know, I wasn't going to go there, but you decided to go there.
Well, we're just quoting lyrics from Fear, so that's you know we can do that. But
that's true. That's true.
So thanks for being on Los Angeles Nisa, you know, today. This is very exciting to me because you're a knowledgeable person of music and. This is basically a non-music show. We do a culture show where mm-hmm. we talk about our guests, whoever they may be. So if they're working in music or movies, we talk about their background. So right. that topic comes up. But then the focus is to speak regionally, like what's your favorite places in LA, whether it's like a gallery or mm-hmm. a venue, and then explain to people how to get there by public transportation, like really push that angle. But we wanted to do... a series of record store day shows because it's coming up and this is the first one. And I wanted to ask you personally, since you're such a fan of music mm-hmm. and heavily immersed working in the music business, what are some of your favorite independent music stores on the East Coast?
Vintage Vinyl.
In Ford's, New Jersey?
In Ford's, New Jersey.
Yeah. Well, has that been like, I mean, say like through your Roadrunner years in New York City, was that like your main store you would buy from or check out?
Yeah. Because I mean, it was the spot. Okay.
Especially for heavy music.
For heavy music. Absolutely.
And rock.
Absolutely.
And rock.
Absolutely. I mean, the best imports, you know, the best import selection out there, the best indie selection.
They really
out
have
there.
Everything.
It's awesome. It's right. awesome. I mean, so when I was, you know, especially when I was living in New Jersey for about 7 or 8 years, I would just go down there every, you know, at least once a week.
That's your weekend stop,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, if you're going to a show at the Birch Hill, say.
Yeah,
if you were going to the Starland Ballroom, you know it was right on the way, so you could stop in, you could pick up, God, the latest Viking power metal, hardcore, whatever you have.
Sure,
and they would have it.
Sure,
that place is really was completely unlike any other record store in the area.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I mean, man, there were other great stores, you know, on the East Coast. I mean, Generation Records in New York City, great store. Great hardcore, great metal selection.
I agree. I've been dealing with them for about a decade.
Okay.
Wholesaling product to them from my day job, Southern Lord.
Yeah.
But I've actually been there to buy records while traveling. Mm-hmm. And I've actually been there on tour and played the store when I was in Revolution Mother. So I've dealt with them from different perspectives and it's just great. They're great people, Rob and Donna Roth, and the buyer, Keith, he's just awesome. He's a, mm-hmm. he's a young guy and he's really smart. I mean, he's very, smart about things. He comes off as, you know, an older guy. He has got a lot of knowledge about his music and go ahead.
Well, I was about to say, while we're here, we need to talk about the demise of Bleecker Bob's.
Well, yeah, since this is the Record Store Day edition. I mean, that was such an institution. I mean, it was even like on Seinfeld.
Totally.
Okay.
Totally.
Tell me about Bleecker Bob's. Was it a place where you got new music or just catalog?
It was a place where you could get, both? You know, at a certain point you got everything there. I mean, it was kind of in the mid and late 80s, it was kind of like the third stop. You would do for record shopping. I mean, the first one, of course, would be Sum Records, where you would get all the Keep It Real hardcore records.
I remember Sum Records.
You get some serious demos there. It was it was a pretty awesome place. Then you'd go to Venus. And Venus would have even a little bit more stuff. I mean, we're also talking like, you know, still talking the vinyl era as well. And, you know, so they would have all the latest 7 inches. You know, some great, you know, whatever was coming out at that point, they'd have. Bleecker Bob's was kind of the cleanup place.
Okay.
You'd go there, you'd see Bob. Bob would be slightly abusive.
Yeah, he would definitely, like, abuse you guys verbally, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And that was kind
Give
of...
Give me a story.
And that was kind of... I don't remember. That was 100 years ago.
Was his MO, right?
Yeah.
Because when Seinfeld, when Costanza went in there with Kramer, he just, like, laid into them.
Yeah.
Like... They're trying to sell Al Jolson records, and he was looking at this, and he threw a bag, goes, I don't need this.
And that was, you know, and the thing is, that guy was such a character.
You loved it.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of, you know, the New York experience. I mean, coming down from Boston, you know, already New York was extremely overwhelming.
Right. Just the pace and the circulation of it.
Yeah, just everything, you know. So going into see Bob at the end of your record shopping experience, before you say you went to a show at the Rock Hotel.
Right.
Was, you know, kind of cool. It was part of the experience.
You hit three stores and then you go see Bob and then you go to the show.
Right, then you go see GBH,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And
you get abused by Bob right before you go to CGV.
Exactly. Like, you know, so that, you know, but I mean, that was many, many years ago, and New York does not look like that or feel like that anymore.
So it's completely different, you would say.
Yeah. It's a completely different place.
Now, some of the other stores I'm very familiar with is, besides, you know, Vintage Vinyl being on the New York map, because they're not too far away, is Generation. Off did a rad live 7-inch there called Live a Generation.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was actually at that show.
Were you?
Yeah.
Nice.
It was down in the basement. It was awesome. Actually, I have an amazing, amazing Generation record story.
Tell me.
Okay. This is when I worked with Killswitch Engage.
Okay.
It was on the first record that I worked on, worked with them on. It was a record called Live or Just Breathing.
Now, just to clarify, this was when you were working at Roadrunner.
Yes, that was when I was working at Roadrunner. Now, they were scheduled to do a MTV You Heard It First piece, and they were going to shoot it at Generation Records. Well, the singer had quit.
Oh, wow.
About a week before. But, you know, we in our infinite wisdom said, we're going to do this piece anyway. So we convinced Jesse, the singer, who's actually back in the band now, to come down and do this interview. And aside from it being exceedingly uncomfortable because you had a singer who quit in the middle of a tour and a band who was pulling it back together as fast as possible and probably had a little bit of resentment about putting them all together, getting them in front of MTV. Well, mid-interview, they're down in the basement of a Generation. Busted. Somehow MTV found out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Tremendous. Like just one of those funny stories.
That's pretty, like, you know, you had to be there kind of thing.
So we walked up the stairs into the sun and just everyone hung their heads in shame.
Oh, wow.
But it was a hilarious, you know, it's just one of those hilarious stories.
Yeah. You know what? I'm going to take a left turn onto the next one really quick because I want to get your perspective on the market place of music, and through your A&R ears and eyes, because you've worked at Atlantic, you've worked at Roadrunner, mm-hmm. and now
Razor and Tie.
Question for you is: when you're putting a project together, I mean, it's the numbers game has changed,
sure.
right? Well, when it comes from that perspective, tell us about the difference between the last 10 years.
I mean, you know, 10 years ago, you could sell hundreds of thousands of records.
And there was more money available for projects,
sure.
right?
Yeah, things were more profitable. You know, what would, you know, I think the difference now is we're forced, not even forced, I mean, we bands, A&R people, record companies are just, they're dealing with smaller budgets. And they're dealing with, you know, still a tremendous influx of product. And so consequently, records have to be that much better. And records have to be, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, I hate to say it, the old days.
Understood. I know where you're getting at.
Where, you know, nobody had a lot of money. Nobody had a lot of money to make records. And records just had to stand, you know, they had to stand on their own merits. So I think in a lot of ways it feels like that climate again.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you can, you know, the other thing is, honestly, yes, you can still sell records, and yes, you can, you know, you make records And sometimes, you know, your budgets can be $6,000, or they can be $60,000, or they can be $100,000.
Right. And if it's a good record, I mean, at the end of the day, I think any genre, if it's a good record, it's a good record. And people, no matter how much promotion is behind it, word is going to travel about it being a good record. And word of mouth still is the most powerful tool in music, I think.
I agree.
Dude, don't you? Like, if someone tells you, you have to see this band or hear this record, that's going to do more more of an influence on you than opening Rolling Stone and seeing a $60,000
ad. Oh, totally.
Right?
Like if I bump into you and you're like, you've got to check out this band.
Sure.
I'm more than likely to put my Tuesday night aside and go hang out with Eddie and go see this awesome band. And actually, there's a few bands that you've turned me on to.
Like?
There's a local band in L.A. called Aegis.
Yep.
Who were not the best live band the first time I saw them.
Right.
At that, but I've seen them grow and grow and grow. And because of, you know, just you saying, go check them out, it's got me to watch them, you know, grow as a band.
Sure. And you've seen them develop and you've kept your eye on them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, and even, you know, even records that you've put out through Southern Lord, bands like Enabler.
Great band.
Amazing band. Probably one of the best hardcore records of last year.
I think so.
You know, so I mean, just you know, like and this is our normal weekly conversation.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, totally. I mean, if we could talk every day, it's this conversation we're having now.
Exactly.
And, you know, sometimes it is every day. Sometimes it's once a week, you know. It's like,
it's not often enough, actually.
Yeah, we got to get back on it.
Yeah.
So with that being said, give me by the decade, it just seems like in the 90s, you were over at Atlantic, right?
93 to 97.
And what bands did you sign?
Jawbox, which is my first signing ever, which I'm still amazingly, it was the first Discord band to go to a major label.
And you signed them?
Yep. And it got the blessing of Ian MacKaye.
Wow.
The next was Bad Religion.
Mm-hmm.
Who I licensed the Recipe for Hate record for, and worked on Stranger Than Fiction, which was the band's biggest selling record. It was a gold record. Another record called The Gray Race, which I think is a really cool and really underrated record in their catalog.
I think the same.
You know, and I think that had a lot to do with Brian Baker joining the, you know, Brian Baker, who was formerly in Minor Threat,
right,
and Dag Nasty and Junkyard.
That Junkyard.
And Junkyard. Dude, do not sleep on Junkyard.
No, I mean, if you like Love Hate, then you got to like Junkyard.
You know, if you,
that's the same deal,
like,
right there.
Bro, if you like Little Caesar,
then you got to like Junkyard.
Yeah. Don't sleep on Little Caesar.
If you like Saigon Kick,
then you like Spread Eagle. If you like Spread, see, we can keep doing this, but you like Spread Eagle, you like the Electric Angels.
Yeah. If you, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
If you like Circus of Power, can you like Junkyard?
Oh, hell yes.
Exactly. See, I know what I'm talking about.
But bro, if you like Circus of Power.
I love Circus of Power, dude.
Are you there for Crucial Truth? And a pretty, you know, really unheralded and probably not that good hardcore band from Florida, the two of the guys were in. But let's also not forget that the bass player in Circus of Power was Zowie from Leeway.
Uh-huh.
Who is not dead, by the way. The rumor is that he has passed away. No, it's not true at all.
Really?
Word is that Zowie can be found somewhere in the Pacific Northwest. That's the rumor. I've also heard San Francisco, but he is still alive.
Well, that's good to know.
Yep.
That's good to know. Now, to me, a key factor of having you in here for this first installation.
Oh, by the way, there were other bands I actually signed there. One was Civ.
Right.
Which was basically another chapter of sort of Gorilla Biscuits Part 2.
Sure. And at one point, they had like gigantic management, like McGee, right?
Yeah.
Like
Scott McGee managed them.
Yeah, I mean, that was like, I mean, here comes like, you know, someone from the hardcore scene. I mean, from the gutter of the hardcore scene. You know, and when I say that, I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm just using that to describe, you know, the way things all happened in that level of the music industry. It's like very like just hands-on, you know, and then all of a sudden they're on Atlantic with the same manager as like Kiss and Bon Jovi.
Well, that was his younger brother, Scott, who managed Skid Row.
Okay.
And also, another band I signed, Orange 9mm, was also managed by McGee.
Okay.
And, what did he bring to those bands, or what did that level of management bring to a band like that? A little bit of a bigger perspective, but I mean, those bands would have made the same records either way.
Right. The thing about it is, just because a band if you have a deal and you're going to have a bigger manager, you still have to do the same amount of work to get to a point where that manager could do something for you.
I mean, yeah. And also, what got you there was probably something that was pretty good to begin with.
Sure.
So why change it? You know, I mean, there's been many great records I've worked on throughout the years. That Civ record, it was done by Don Fury.
Yeah,
Who's done a million great Revelation records and New York hardcore records. It's the same record. It's the same record they would have made if they were on Revelation. The Killswitch Engage records were done by their guitar player Adam Duckowitz.
Well, let's do this. Let's move on to the Roadrunner years.
We're gonna moving on.
Right, right. Now at Roadrunner, that was year what to year what?
Roadrunner was 97 to 2009, which was an astounding amount of time for any A&R person.
Right. So that was 12 years?
Yeah.
And you were there during the Ozfest tenure.
I was there for Roadrunner Owns Ozfest.
Yeah, that was like 4 years in a row.
Yep. Actually, I think it was the first on Ozfest, but I remember it was right as I was joining the company. They had Typo, Vision of Disorder,
Biohazard. They weren't on. Cold Chamber, Fear Factory.
Yep.
Machine Head.
All those bands were on. Yeah.
I was at the first one. I was at Blockbuster. One show. It wasn't a tour.
Well, no. The 97 was...
An official tour.
Yeah, 97 was an official tour. I think the lineup you're talking about was that one first show.
Yeah, with Neurosis and Prong.
Right.
Or no, Danzig.
And Earth Crisis.
Yeah, Earth Crisis.
Who I ended up signing at Roadrunner.
Ah. Yep. Yeah. Good move.
Breathe Those Killers, dude.
Jeremy is a huge Earth Crisis fan.
Really?
Jeremy's the owner of Skid Row. Tell us about Earth Crisis.
I grew up on the East Coast, so like all those bands from New York and Snapcase and Earth Crisis.
Integrity,
all those bands were big where I'm from. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, when you mention that, it's kind of like, Jeremy here was immersed in that scene and understands it. But it's really, I remember seeing, their first record, Earth Crisis, on Roadrunner. I was like, wow, like, I understand where they came from. And I understood the standard of Roadrunner and how most of the band sounded and what kind of platform they would be operating on. And it didn't not make sense. It made sense because that sound was like, this is going to be like the new heavy sound.
Well, and I think the great thing about that record is it's probably their most ferocious sounding record.
It is. It's brutal.
I mean, Andy Sneap did an amazing job producing and mixing that record. It has probably the sickest guitar sound
ever.
Yep. I know Hatebreed has actually
referenced that.
Yeah.
As a mix?
Yep. As a mix and as a guitar sound, which is pretty amazing. Carl's vocals on that record don't even sound human.
Oh, it's very true. I mean, during those sessions, you were there, right?
I wasn't physically there. I popped in once, said hello, got to hear stuff as it was going down. But yeah, it was, I mean, working with those guys was a great experience. That record is an insanely good record. And I think it's, a lot of people consider that one of their best records.
Right. And as far as, that's like their landmark record when it comes to like taking it to the next level as far as sound in the studio. I think so.
Kind of, I don't know if they actually ever really went to the next level. It was certainly one of the best things they've ever done.
Well, I mean, just the way it was recorded, like you said.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like
at Pyramid Sound.
Sure.
Home to, thrash in the 80s, basically.
Yeah. Now, bringing you in, I mean, it's funny because people think of Record Store Day and they think about exclusive titles coming from the majors and the indies going into all these mom and pops for one day. But there's also another component, and it's people like you that sign bands, you know, the A&R of the world that put the deals together and get things happening, whether it's a recording contract or it's a license, you know? So, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, like you said, I mean, you lasted 12 years at Roadrunner. That's a long time for an A&R position.
It's really strange.
I think the standard is like 4.
Yeah, this is this is bizarrely my 20th year doing A&R.
Wow.
I don't understand it. Let's put it that way. But I feel very fortunate and have worked with some great bands over the years, and you know, am continuing to work with some great bands as well.
Absolutely. Like, tell us who.
In fact, my first Razor and Tie signing is the band Him.
Right.
Who I, you know, have known both, I've been a fan of and, you know, personally known for many years. And it's great, you know, having an opportunity to work with those guys.
What's the street date for that?
April 30th.
Okay, so you got a big date coming up.
Yeah, big day.
Yeah. Now, so a band like that, like, where will they play in L.A. when they do a headlining show?
They're doing two nights at House of Blues.
Okay.
Both of which are sold out.
Very respectable. And way in advance.
Yeah.
That's, yeah. I mean, let me tell you something. A lot of bands that, you know, are pretty good size don't do two nights at House of Blues.
You know what, though? Him is a band that I think just has a connection to their fans, unlike most bands.
Sure.
And I think that's, you know, they're a band. I mean, also they haven't toured America that much,
so they haven't overplayed.
No, they haven't been here. They haven't been here in a couple of years, and it's a very, you know, it's a short tour. You know, it's major markets. And most of them are sold out.
So it's like, you know, L.A., San Francisco, Portland, Seattle.
New York,
Chicago.
God, I wish I had the itinerary in front of me. I don't even think it's, you know, some of those markets.
Right.
They're going to be
just major.
Yeah, they're going to be back in the fall for a more extensive tour.
I think that's great. Well, you know, Mike, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for having.
We're going to wrap it up.
Okay.
And we're going to get you the podcast link tomorrow. And everyone out there listening, thank you for tuning in to the first installment of the Record Store Day series via Los Angeles, Nista, and Skid Row Studios. Thank you.
So I'm saying.